Well, we are going to be in Genesis chapter 1. We are beginning a new series today. Grateful for Ben and James to fill in the last couple weeks. And it, you know, like everything, it kind of breaks up the routine and the flow of things, so everything feels a little bit off. So we're hoping that the time together that we have today is going to be still edifying and encouraging to you. But it's difficult to kind of get back into the normal flow of things after you have some time off, after you spend some time working on church projects and home projects and all of the other stuff. So the series in Genesis is why Genesis? Why do we want to go back all the way to the beginning? Let me give you a couple reasons for that. But on the one hand, just want to warn you that we're not going to spend the next 50 weeks or whatever, or 5 years in the book of Genesis, just starting from verse 1 and going all the way through it. That just probably would not be very helpful, and we probably would get bogged down at certain points. But there's one reason basically that drove me back here, is that I wanted to teach through historical narrative, specifically from the Old Testament. So if you have been with us for a certain amount of time, you know that we did a long series through the book of Matthew off and on. But the last 6 months or so, 4 months or so, we've really kind of done smaller series. So we've gone through and looked at some of the Advent stuff. We did a few topical sermons on abortion, and on some of the gender confusion that's taking place in January. And then we've even done a few things in the Minor Prophets. So we've jumped around a little bit. We've touched on some smaller topics and smaller books of the Bible. And now I think we're ready to kind of jump into something that's going to be a little bit longer. So we're going to back up from the New Testament, back all the way to the very beginning, and start in a book that would be largely considered historical narrative. So we're looking at a very different type of genre than what we've looked at, like in Peter's epistle when we did that back in the fall in last year. So this is a little shift in our understanding of how we read the Bible, how we understand it. We're going back to a different language, so we're going to be looking at the Hebrew language in which Genesis was written, and we're going to be learning different things about that, which may or may not be accurately reflected in your translation. So we're going to encounter different things that challenge our understanding of the first book of the Bible. So Genesis actually breaks down into several sections, so we don't have to necessarily start at the beginning and work all the way through. And there's specific moments when we can take a break and we can kind of move on into something different and then come back and pick up right where we left off without any sort of roadblocks. So Genesis, for the most part, breaks up into the first 11 chapters, which kind of give an overview of the creation and the fall and the flood and then the repercussions of the flood up until the Tower of Babel. So we have the first 11 chapters of Genesis that deal with God's creation and his interaction with his creation in this world up until the division or the separation or the scattering of the nations after the Tower of Babel. The story of Genesis continues from that moment by focusing in on one of those families that descended from those people. So the first 11 chapters are kind of an overview of a very long period of time before focusing in on a very small family. Thinking about Abraham at the time, the Bible focuses on Abraham in Genesis, the end of Genesis 11. He has a wife and no descendants. So we're talking about a very large group of people over a long period of time that actually covers a lot of ground really quickly. And then when we get to Abraham, the story slows down and it focuses in on one specific family. And that's really the rest of the Bible. So what we can do is we can look at Genesis 1 through 11, and then we can look at the story of Abraham and his descendants. So we can look at this probably in four different chunks. We would look at first 11 chapters, story of Abraham, and we can look at his descendants, so his son Isaac and Jacob. And then the last section of Genesis really focuses in on one more character, the story of Joseph. So from Genesis like 36 on to the end, it really focuses on one particular character. So that's basically our approach to Genesis. Now, that's not the structure of the book necessarily. There's other structural indicators in the book that we'll look at. But from a practical standpoint, that's where we're at. We want to be in the Old Testament. We want to read historical narrative. Genesis fits the bill, so we don't have to talk necessarily about all the bloody wars and the evil and the sinful cycle of the book of Judges or the idolatry taking place and the other prophets. We're going to look at Genesis. Now, there are other reasons why Genesis is foundational. So, we recognize that every book of the Bible is useful for us. Every book is equally inspired, breathed out by God, can help us grow and be trained in wisdom and righteousness. But not every book does so to the same degree. So there are some that are more important than others. Now, if you faithfully read through your Bible and you happen to skip the book of Obadiah every time you read through it, I don't think that there would be anything necessarily missing in your walk and relationship with God. Genesis seems to be a more important book than any of the other books in the Old Testament. It's one of those types of books that reveal to us more about God, more about the world in which we find ourselves, more about ourselves, more about what's wrong with us, and more about God's plan than perhaps any other book. So we'll use that example of an architecture to make this point. Some books are more like walls. Some books are more like windows. Some books are more like doors. Some are like the rafters above our heads. Some books fit that bill fairly well. If that's the example we're using, Genesis would be the foundation, right? Genesis are the footings, the forms. This is what the house rests upon. Genesis is like that. We know a house that doesn't have a very strong foundation won't last very well. If there's any sort of ground shaking or earthquaking, if there's any sort of high winds, the house is simply going to crash. So without Genesis, our house crumbles. We can survive without the finished work, as my home would attest. But our house won't survive very long without the foundation. So we can't adequately understand God, His plan, or ourselves without the book of Genesis. Now it's interesting to me, just to give you a couple examples of this in the Bible, it's not as if, a couple examples. What does Paul do in the book of Acts when he goes and he preaches the gospel to the Gentiles? Where does he start in the story? He starts in creation, right? It's not as if he's going and telling them all that they need to know of the book of Genesis. He's not unpacking Genesis for them, but he goes back to the beginning and he says, no, you guys have gotten it wrong. This God has made you. He fashioned you. He is your creator. So whether he's in Lystra and in Lystra, what was it that took place? They were preaching the gospel, and the people of Lystra thought that Paul and Barnabas were the gods themselves, the gods become incarnate. So Paul is the orator, Barnabas is the supporting cast, and what they want to do is they want to offer up sacrifices to these two deities. And Paul corrects their misunderstanding and says, no, that's not the case. We are not gods. But we do know the true God, the Creator God. He made you for yourselves. He appointed times and seasons. He scattered you about and placed you around the world. God is the Creator God. He does the same thing in Athens when he walks through and he sees all of the idols that have been made, and he sees the idol that has been made to the unknown God, and that's where he begins with them. Paul begins preaching the gospel to Gentiles who do not share the same story as Israelites do, by pointing them back to the beginning. God has formed you and made you. This is the God that you are accountable to. He is the ruler and He is the judge. So, what does Genesis tell us about God? Genesis tells us that God is creator, that God is spirit. He is the energizing principle of the world. He is the ruler, the judge, and the covenant maker. So looking broadly at our understanding that we derived of God from the book of Genesis, we see that God is creator, spirit, ruler, judge, and covenant maker. Now, even considering the names of God given to us in Genesis provides further insight. God reveals Himself on the pages of the first book of the Bible as the Most High God. He is God Most High, El Elyon. He is the Lord. He is Adonai. He is the ruler or the master. He is the God who sees. Right? That's Hagar's depiction. Hagar names God as the God who sees. He is God Almighty, El Shaddai. He is the everlasting God, God Olam. He is the eternal God. And of course, we all know He is Yahweh Yireh. He is the God who provides. So we see that even in the pages of Genesis, we have clear understanding of who God is and how He relates to this world. And then we have the personal, relational aspects of Him, where God is actually revealing to us His personal name in all of those varieties of different ways. So that is what Genesis tells us about God. Well, what does Genesis tell us about us? Genesis tells us that we are creatures. Now, I don't know the last time that you thought of yourself as a creature, but it would be helpful if you did. That you are a creature, created being. You had a beginning, and you will have an end. So it's helpful for us to understand that, because I don't think we think about it enough. We are created beings, according to Genesis, created beings made in the image and likeness of the Creator God. So the Creator God, the ruler, the sovereign judge, the covenant maker, made us, made mankind in His image and likeness. Interesting, if you read through, we'll go through Genesis 1 in the coming weeks, and what we see happening is not only does God declare Himself to be the Creator, there's specific markers in the first chapter where He says that again. And one of those places is when He creates mankind. He creates them as almost a separate act of creation, or drawing specific attention to the fact that He has made us, that we are His creatures in His image and likeness in Genesis 1. Genesis also tells us where we are. So, where are you? Well, you are on the land that the Creator God made when He separated the waters from the land. Now, that's not necessarily how you would answer the question. But the author of Genesis says specifically that is what God has done. He's created a place for you to dwell. So the idea then that we approach Genesis with is probably not the one that the author of Genesis had, or any ancient Israelite would have. What does he do? He takes a world that is covered with water and darkness, and he separates the waters, and he causes the waters to accumulate and go somewhere else so that dry land appears. And that is the specific place where He puts man. He puts man in the land. So mankind is made, created in the image and likeness of God. Then he's placed on a specific piece of land that God has made for him. Genesis also tells us what's wrong with us. So, it tells us who we are, it tells us where we are, it tells us what's wrong with us. So, what's wrong with you? Well, you're like your first parents. You're like the man and the woman who rebelled against the Creator God. So, you're like the first couple who were placed in a specific place, created, placed in a specific place, given a specific task, and then you choose not to do that task and do what the Creator God has told you not to do. That is who you are. That's what's wrong with you, is that you actually don't want to be told by the Creator God what you should be doing. You don't want to listen to your Creator. You want to follow your own ways. You're just like the man and the woman. So we are their descendants. Where did we come from? We came from them. We came from the man and the woman. Now from them we inherit our exalted status as image bearers, made in the image and likeness of God, and from them we inherit our fallenness. So we are rebels just like they are. The apple has not fallen far from the tree. And though we still live in the land that God formed, we now live like they did in exile. We live as castaways, banished from the land, from the garden, suffering the consequences of our rebellion and striving against the seed of the serpent. So like they did, they have an enemy. We do also. So that is what the Bible, that's what Genesis tells us about ourselves. It tells us who we are, it tells us where we are, it tells us what's gone wrong, and it tells us what we are in dire need of. Now, Genesis also tells us God's plan to defeat our enemy and to bring us back to the life that we had with God in the beginning. So thinking about those foundational principles, right? Our understanding of who God is, our understanding of who we are, and our understanding of what God is going to do about it. What is He going to do? Genesis is the first book, and there is an abundance of material to describe what God is going to do to bring us back, to solve the problem, to defeat our enemy, to, in one way, reunite heaven and earth. So God promises to provide a seed, to provide an offspring, a son, who will defeat our enemy and save the world. That's basically it. Very short statement that describes what God's plan is. Defeat the enemy and save the world. Now, what do we actually see happening? What we actually see happening at the end of Genesis is a picture of that taking place in microcosm. So what happens at the end of Genesis? Well, Joseph, the beloved son of his father Jacob, is betrayed, sold into slavery, falsely accused, imprisoned, and forgotten. But then he is exalted to the highest position under Pharaoh and saves the world from a severe famine. Now, it doesn't take much for us to actually connect that story to the story of Jesus, because that's really ultimately what it's about. So what we have then is a picture of the gospel told through the story of Joseph. How was it that God was going to save the world? Well, he was going to do so through a son who was loved, but also severely mistreated. So these are the foundational truths that are first revealed to us in Genesis that become fundamental to our understanding of God, His plan, and ourselves. So Genesis is the beginning. As we all know, everything important, everything foundational to a story is laid out in the beginning. So here's a quote from Walter Vogels. He says this: "The first pages of any book are always important because they set the tone." Well, that's an interesting thought. You probably haven't approached Genesis like that, but that's in one sense what Genesis is doing. We're laying the foundation, we're setting the tone. From this, you will be able to understand those foundational things about how you think of God, how you understand yourselves, why you find yourselves here on this rock, on this land, and what's wrong with you and what God is going to do about it. So, what do we find then on the first pages of the first book of the Bible? In other words, what tone is the author setting? What is this about? I think Vogel kind of hits the nail on the head here with this quote. This is a little longer one, so bear with me. He says this: one can never stress enough the importance of the first 11 chapters of Genesis in the Bible as a whole. We often think of the Bible as being the history of Israel, but if this were the case, the Bible then would be only the national history, which starts with creation. The first 11 chapters of Genesis do not speak of Israel, but of humanity, of all of us, to whatever race or tribe we may belong. The readers are invited to start their reading of the Bible not with the history of Israel, nor even with Jesus, but with these profound reflections about humankind. So that is where the Bible begins. Bible begins with a picture of us all, a description of God creating a world that is fashioned specifically for us, describing what went wrong in that process when mankind rebelled against the Creator God, and about His plan to make things right. Foundational things necessary for us to understand ourselves, God, His plan, and to be able to see this clearly together. So, with all of that said, let's actually look at Genesis 1. I still have more to say, but we should at least turn there if we're going to be talking about it. So thinking about Genesis, just when we think of Genesis 1 in the creation account, we cannot help but kind of bring our own framework into our understanding of what's happening in Genesis 1. You can't help it. And we can't simply forget about our understanding of the world and kind of put that to the side and think, well, this is just primeval history, or, you know, this is an account of a scientific account or explanation of the origins of the universe or something like that. We cannot help but think those things when we approach the first chapter of Genesis. But I want to try to just kind of expose for one sense that you have a framework like that, and that you bring it to the text so that you're aware of it, you're consciously aware of it, and then we can kind of interact with it as we work our way through it. We're really not going to get far. We're going to get through the first verse. So this is going to be a really long series through the book of Genesis. So let me just give you a few examples. There are rival stories to our origins. Okay, you guys are well aware of this. You know that there are alternate theories, hypotheses, ideas of where we came from, of who we are, and how we got here, and what's wrong with us. Okay, we are well aware of this, and of course, you know, of course, the prevailing rival theory of the biblical account of creation in Genesis is the theory of Darwinian evolution. So, this is the theory that derives or originates in the scientific community, grows out of the Enlightenment, so a movement, you know, 250 years ago or something like that, that is by and large the prevailing theory of our origins in the world today. So I do say rival because I do believe that any account of our origin that does not acknowledge God as the creator of all things, or that espouses random mutation and natural selection as the means by which we came into being, is at odds with the account of creation in the Bible. So this is a rival because it's an alternate explanation of where we came from. And the theory is that something happened a really, really, really long time ago to create everything that we know as we know it, and that through that process, certain things grew and adapted and happened randomly. They just happened to pick the best options with those random mutations and grew and developed into who we are today. So when you think about the question about where we came from or who we are, you're the result of natural selection and random mutation. Those things happen. This is the answer that those scientific theories would actually provide. Now, we can't help but approach Genesis with that thinking in our minds. So when we read the books, the first chapter of Genesis, we're thinking that this story in Genesis 1 is written to defeat that rival theory. It's written to counteract and attack that rival theory, which it wasn't written to do that. That theory didn't exist more than 250 years ago, at least as far as I know. Maybe it did, but it wasn't popularized until the origin of the species. So when we approach Genesis, then we should primarily not be thinking, well, this contradicts evolutionary theory of our origins. That's not why it was written. Now, does it do that? I would say yes, but that's not why it was written. But the interesting thing here, though, is that it was written in light of other rival theories of origins, just not the evolutionary theory of origins. So, as far as I can tell, every nation in the ancient world had their own origin story. Think about this. If you find yourself in Palestine surrounded by 70 different nations who all worship different gods than you do, what are those nations going to say about how they got here? Well, they're going to say that their gods made them. And that's, in fact, what we find. So there are other prevailing rival theories of origins that the Israelites are interacting with on a daily basis. So Israel was not unique in having their own account of creation. These other nations had some sort of story that told about their gods and how they created the world. Now, what's interesting about this approach to Genesis 1 is that we see similarities that exist between these stories. So, thinking about the evolutionary and the creationism approach to Genesis 1, we see that these are clearly at odds with one another. They have virtually nothing in common. The only thing that they agree in common is that we are here, and that there was a beginning at some point, right? So we know that there's no way that these two ideas can mesh, even though that there are evangelicals who try to mesh them and fit them together. So there are evangelicals who would approach Genesis 1 and say that we can interject into Genesis 1 evolution. You could do it between verse 1 and verse 2. You could do it in verse 1 itself. You could do it by saying that the days here are actually very, very, very long periods of time. So you can put evolution into the text if you want. That's not necessarily what you should do, but you could do that. They're trying to reconcile those two ideas, but they are completely at odds with one another. The difference between this creation story, though, and the other creation stories of the nations surrounding Israel is that they did share many things in common. So in an article in the IVP Dictionary series, John Walton describes 15 different features that these creation stories share in common. So they describe a chaotic beginning, primal conditions. There is a mention of seas, of light, of creation by speech, of naming, of separating waters, of an expanse or a firmament, of seasons and calendars, of sea creatures, animals, of dust and clay, of the breath of life, of the image of God, and of rest. So, you know, doing a very brief survey of the other creation origin stories of the nations of the ancient Near East, you see that these things are in common. So if you're thinking about Genesis 1 in light of that cultural context, and you happen to have a friend who's a Babylonian, and you hear his origin story, he says, well, that sounds a lot like my origin story. I wonder why these things are similar. I wonder how these things came about. Now, at the same time, we recognize that the account of creation in Genesis is remarkably different than that of the surrounding nations and their rival theories. So there are similarities, but there are very remarkable differences. I'll give you one example here. This is from the Enuma Elish, but it's like the Babylonian account of creation. So thinking about the Babylonian account of creation in the Enuma Elish, listen to what happens. So in the Enuma Elish, what happens is that Marduk, he battles against the sea goddess, whose name is Tiamat. And it's a ferocious battle. So thinking about the picture of the primordial world, we have this darkness and this water encompassing the earth. That's chaotic. The Spirit of God is there hovering over the waters. Well, in their account, Marduk is fighting against the sea, fighting against the ferocious goddess, like this thing that cannot be beaten or tamed, and he defeats her. He defeats her after a very long battle. And what does he do? He takes her and he separates her, cuts her in two. He puts half of her up into the expanse, up into the firmament, and he puts boundaries upon the waters that are up there so that they don't come down again. And then he gathers the waters that are left on the earth and he groups them together. And then what's left is the land upon which he creates man and places man. So in that example, what we see happening is similar things that we see happening in the book of Genesis, right? God is there hovering over the waters. He separates the waters. He gathers the waters together. He puts boundaries upon the waters so that they don't cross those boundaries. And then he puts man upon the land that's there. But the difference is that God doesn't do this in a ferocious battle. God speaks, and the waters do what he tells them to do. So God, the Creator, the Most High God, higher than Marduk, higher than Tiamat, he tells the waters what to do, and they do what they're told. He says, you go up there and stay there. You go over there and stay there and let the dry land be here. So God then is described as truly the sovereign. This is Walton again. He says this, in the Genesis creation narrative, the serenity and effortlessness of the creation process stand in stark contrast to the uproar and confusion that often characterizes the ancient Near Eastern myths. So the difference then is that, yes, these myths depict their understanding of reality as they worship these pagan gods. But what do those gods actually look like? They look a lot like themselves. That's how they do battle. That's how they think they should rule the world. But the true God and the true story of creation, the true origin story, simply speaks and he creates. He says things and his words accomplish things. He's not out there fighting a battle. He speaks and the world is made. So we can see a lot of other connections that are similar to that, but different with those other ancient stories. So it's possible that the creation account recorded in Genesis was written to counter those rival theories. So it's written within that context, where we see God creating different than all the other gods create. And it's kind of written as an apologetic. It's like, this is the true God. This is the God that is the God of all gods. The gods to whom all will bow down. The Creator, the Ruler, the Judge, the Covenant Maker. And this is how he creates. But we know also, I told you I thought we were going to get to Genesis 1, but thinking about this though, Genesis is not just the beginning of the book of the Bible, it's the beginning of a collection of books. It's the beginning of the Pentateuch. And this is where we have possibly some other connections that are being made. So in the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible, there's going to be constant references back to Genesis and even to the creation account. So some of these we've seen the last few weeks with Ben when he had mentioned the commandments and how God has ordered and structured the commandments around from Sabbath observance to the making of idols around the creation account. So the appeal in the Sabbath commandment is an appeal back to creation. 6 days God made the world, and what did he do on the seventh day? He rested, right? He took a Sabbath. He rested on the seventh day. It has an appeal back to the creation account. When we're instructed not to make idols, the idols that are referred to are the idols that God makes in Genesis chapter 1. Don't make any image of the beasts of the land, of the birds of the sky, or of the fish in the seas. Don't make an image like that of those things that God made to worship. Why? Because they're just creatures as well. They're not the true creator God. And we also see an emphasis upon the word here of land. You can't read the Pentateuch and not see the connections that are made from the very beginning all the way throughout the end of the Pentateuch about the promised land. So when we see the words that are being used here, we can see it in light of that context. God is making a specific place for his people. He is forming them and putting them where he wants them to be. And this place in Genesis 2 is described as a garden. This place that's in Abraham is a land of promise, the land of Canaan, and is a place of rest, a place of blessing, a place of fruitfulness and abundance. God is promising to give them this place. You can't read through the rest of the Pentateuch without recognizing that the Pentateuch begins with a depiction of God making a place, creating a place for his people. So all of that kind of feeds into our understanding of Genesis. Let's look at verse 1, though. That was a long introduction, sorry. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Seven words, at least in Hebrew, that are extremely important. The first line of the Bible is that God created the heavens and the earth. Now, there's a lot of different interpretations of Genesis 1, like overwhelming amount of interpretations of Genesis 1. Some of them have to do with how verse 1 relates to the rest of the chapter. So, are these describing two different things? Does verse 1 kind of give us an overview of what's going to take place in the rest of chapter 1? It kind of introduces for us the reality that we're going to see as he unpacks it in verse 1 or in the rest of the chapter, or is it talking about something completely different? Like some would literally read verse 1 as completely separate from what he does in verse 2 through the end of the chapter. So what you have here is you have two separate, in one way, creation accounts. One that describes God creating all things, the heavens and the earth, an all-encompassing, universal, created act of God. And then at some point in the past, in verse 2, God intervenes and takes what has been made and shapes and fashions it for his purposes. Some see that as a legitimate interpretation. Now, I think what he's doing is he's introducing what's going to happen in verse 2 through the end of the chapter. But the whole chapter into chapter 2 is kind of an introduction to the rest of the book of Genesis. So thinking about this, when you think of the beginning, what do you think of? When you think of heavens and earth, what comes to mind? Okay, this is where we're bringing our framework into the text, right? So the beginning, the Bereshit, it's just a simple word that says that something has started. It comes from the word for head, meaning like the head and not the tail. So the beginning of something implying that there's more things to follow afterwards. So this would seem to be, at least from the, you know, the language that's used in the Bible, it would seem to be an indication that what he is referring to here is the start of something. So in the beginning, we can think of as the start. There is something that took place at this moment in time, and from that, a series of events happened. God, in the beginning, created the heavens and the earth. Well, what happened before that? The Bible doesn't tell you. So what about the idea then of God creating? So something started in the beginning. Who started it? God. Elohim started it. Not Marduk, not Tiamat. Elohim started it. And what did he do? What did he start? He created. He barred it. So this is important for us to understand that God is always either the explicit or the implicit subject of the word create. Bara. He creates. No one else creates. This is unique to who God is. So when we think of God as our creator, we're thinking of him not just as the source of all things, not just as the one who made all things, we're thinking of him in his unique role that no one else can do. This separates then for us in our understanding between the creator and anything that's made. So here is the radical distinction between creator and creation. Creation cannot create. So creation can make stuff out of stuff, but the word create is never used of creation. That is only used of God. You think of the prayer of repentance of David when he says, create in me a clean heart. What is he acknowledging by saying that? He's not only asking God to do it, he's recognizing that God is the only one that can do it. God is the only one who possesses the ability to create something new, something clean. So implicitly, from the very first verse, we see that God creates. And what does he create? He creates the heavens and the earth. So the framework that we bring to this then, when you think of the heavens and the earth, if I can get into your mind, you're thinking about the planet. Or you're thinking about the globe. You're picturing earth from the perspective of space, right? Maybe. I don't know what you're thinking, but that was just a guess. So, just thinking about this, just the heavens. What do you think about when you hear the word heavens? What's that, Ed?
I said a place to go eventually.
Yeah. Do you think about that as a place to go? How do you get there? If you were to jump on one of Elon's rockets and ride it forever up into the space, would you find heaven? No. On one hand, no. If it's a place to go, no. But thinking about the language that's being used here, this is somewhat tricky. Because if it's describing a place to go, and he says that God created here, then where was God before that? Was he in heaven? If it's a place to go, then do they know how to get there? Now think about the word earth. Now that obviously gives us a kind of a global perspective. We're thinking about the planet when we hear the word earth. right? So on the one hand, we could say God created the heavens, which we would presume to be either a place to go, or we presume to be the universe, which is incredibly massive, and he created Earth, which was like a part of the universe, but the specific part of the universe in which we find ourselves today. So, interesting that the word Earth is a word that gets used repeatedly throughout Genesis 1, just like the word heavens. Heavens, actually, if you look at, let's see, verse 8, okay, let's look at verse 7. God made the expanse. So here's the water-covered earth. He's making an expanse in the midst of the waters. He's separating the waters from one another, right? He's doing the act of separation. The space that he calls, that exists between the waters, is called the expanse, or the firmament. And in verse 8, he says it's called heaven. So he creates, he separates the waters. He puts the waters above, and he puts the waters below. The space that exists between the waters, the expanse or the firmament, is called heaven. So what should we think of when we think of the word heaven? Which again, here is the same word that's used throughout chapter 1. We should think of it as the space between the waters. There's waters above, beyond the firmament, and there's waters below that are gathered together. So from the perspective of someone who doesn't think of the planet, like, we didn't have that first kind of satellite picture of the Earth until 80 years ago. So we had no idea what the Earth looked like from space until relatively recently. So that means that no ancient Israelite living thousands of years ago would have had that perspective when they read Genesis 1. So what are the heavens? Well, the heavens are where the birds fly. Verse 20, God said, "Let the waters swarm with swarms of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the expanse of the heavens." So, heavens, not a place to go in Genesis 1:1. Not the universe, because the birds don't fly out there in space. They fly under the waters in the expanse called heaven. In other words, they fly in the sky. So the perspective then that we can have by reading consistently through the passage is that what he's saying is that he's creating sky. And what does the sky look like? We'll get into this next week, but it looks like, if you go out there today, you're going to see a very blue ceiling or roof over you, right? Not conceptually thinking about what's beyond that, what's beyond our atmosphere or what we would call space. It's just a blue covering. So the word that gets used to describe the firmament, the rakia, is a word that is actually, it's like a thinly veiled, hardened piece of material, which just happens to be blue, or which is kind of like a gem type of coloring. So from the perspective of an Israelite, when he's thinking about God creating it, he's making it fit for human beings, he's fixing these things in their places, and he's putting other things in their place. He's making the space, and then he's taking creatures and putting the creatures in the space that he's just made. So why are there more than one heavens? Why is heavens plural? Why does it not just say sky? We don't think of the skies. Yeah, this gets into other accounts of creation. They describe seven heavens, which sounds more Mormon to me. They describe three heavens, you know, which is, again, another from another creation origin depiction. So what's happening, though, is that God is creating this space, the heavens, plural, all the way through. Even in the New Testament, we have references to the heavens as being plural. The kingdom of heaven, the kingdom of heavens, the kingdom of the skies. So what we see consistently throughout the Bible is that it's referred to in this way. There are more than one place above us. There's the expanse, and beyond the expanse, there's water, and beyond that, there's God's space. Not a separate dimension, not a dimension that you can't travel to, but the space where God dwells. It's beyond the expanse. Okay, so what we see then in this, just the first verse, challenging our understanding of the framework that we bring to the text, not looking at it specifically as something that counteracts the evolutionary theory, though it does, but something that simply would declare from the very beginning that the God of the Israelites, the God who has revealed himself to these people, the small nation of people, is the maker, the creator of heaven and earth. Here is the creator God. This is the God that started it all and that brought it into existence. The God who fashioned and formed it and filled it with his creatures. He is the creator God. There is none like him. He creates light. He creates darkness. He creates calamity. He creates peace. He is the creator God. That is what the Bible declares at the very beginning. That the God who is going to reveal himself to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and save a people out of Egypt, and give his law to Moses, is the creator God. The God who is in relationship with his image bearers. The God who shows them mercy when they fall. The God who judges when they rebel, and yet preserves a remnant. This is the creator God. So how do we wrap this up then with an understanding of Jesus in Colossians 1? Well, in Colossians 1, we see that Jesus is the creator. He is the one who made all things. Things up there and things down here. He is the creator. He is the reconciler. What does he do by his blood? He reunites what God had separated in Genesis 1. He brings peace where there's enmity, and he brings unity where there has been separation. So God unites all things up there and down here in his Son. That's what happens. He is the beginning, the start of something new. So this is the passage that we can look to see that the Bible both begins with a new creation and it concludes with a new creation. What we see in the Bible then that ties things together is the creation story, not just of our planet, but the creation story of a people who dwelt with God in the specific place that God had made for them. And the Bible concludes in the same way. There is a creation, a new creation in Christ. A new heavens and a new earth. Where what? Where God dwells among his people. Where there is this unity taking place as the new Jerusalem comes from heaven down to earth and exists there without the sun, without the moon, because the glory of God fills it. So what we have is a connection then to the rest of the story. Genesis begins with God creating it, beginning the story, showing us what we need and how he accomplishes it, and it concludes then with God creating a new heavens and a new earth. The story begins where it ends. What we have here in the beginning is anticipatory, not just of what God was going to do in Genesis 1, but what God was going to do in his Son, who is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, the image of the invisible God, the one who unites all things in himself. So the story begins there and anticipates the end of the story where it's fulfilled in Christ. So let's pray and then we'll participate in the Lord's table.